Hello and welcome back. If you're coming back, or welcome for the first time, if this is your first session, we've just heard a fantastic talk from Eric Bierbaum of Harvard University, as well as some engaging questions from the audience that followed. And now we're about to turn our attention to the character and public life panel discussion. And what I'm about to do is introduce Rogan Kirsch. Thank you, Rogan, who's just come onto the screen. Rogan is gonna be our moderator for this conversation to follow. Rogan is the provost at Wake Forest University and professor of political science. He has extraordinary experience in the academy as well as in politics himself. He has written over 50 academic articles, is a regular speaker in various media contexts, has worked in US Congress, the British Parliament, and at think tanks around the world. He is an impressive scholar and a beloved teacher and a fantastic leader at Wake Forest and in the broader community. And we're really grateful, Rogan, to have you with us today moderating this conversation. So welcome. To give you all in the audience a heads up as to what's going to happen, Rogan is going to introduce our panelists, and then there will be a free-flowing conversation with the panelists. We just finished a Q&A, but as a reminder for those who heard this earlier, or if you didn't, I'm letting you know now, there won't be an audience Q&A component to this part of the panel discussion. Okay. And then at the end, I'll pop back on for just a moment to wrap things up. But I'm about to hand it on over to Provost Dr. Rogan Kirsch. All yours. Welcome.
Yes, and welcome all. Big thanks to the Program for Leadership and Character at Wake Forest, as well as the Oxford Character Project, for this really signal 3 days that are to follow and how well begun we already are. Let me do as Kenneth promised and introduce these fabulous panelists. Donna Edwards is a former U.S. representative for Maryland's 4th Congressional District and a member of the Democratic Party in Congress from 2008 to 2017. She served on the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission and the Committees on Transportation Infrastructure, Science and Technology, and, most pertinent for our work today, the Committee on Ethics. Representative Edwards is also a vital member of the Board of Trustees here at Wake Forest. Bill Haslam is a successful businessman and the former governor of Tennessee. He's a member of the Republican Party, so we've got great cross-party bipartisan conversation going on here today. Serving as mayor of Knoxville from 2003 to 2011, he was elected governor of Tennessee in 2010. 4 years later, he won re-election by the largest margin in modern Tennessee history. K. Sabeel Rahman is the newly appointed senior counselor in the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the Office of Management and Budget, the core mighty office in the West Wing of the White House. He's on leave from Brooklyn Law School, where he's an associate professor. He was also, as Kenneth said earlier, the president of Demos for the last 4 years, the think and do tank that drives so many progressive ideas in Washington. All right, fellow panelists, I am so deeply honored to be here with each of you. As Ed Brooks of the Oxford Character Project put in his introduction, you are wise leaders and ethical thinkers of the utmost quality. And let's get right to it. Professor Bierbaum, as he began his talk, described political ethics as an oxymoronic project. That view, of course, has a long history in this and many other countries. The public views those engaged in political life as, at least collectively, possessing dubious character at best. Elected officials and bureaucrats habitually score at the bottom on public ratings of ethics of various professional realms. To each of you, a two-part question to start. As you served or serve in public office, how did you deal with such cynicism from your constituents, from those you were seeking to serve? And what advice do you have for young people in this audience who might be attracted to a career in public life, but turned off by the unrelenting negativity from so many fellow Americans of both parties about the profession of public service? Representative Edwards, we'll start with you.
Wow, Rogan, it hurts my heart to hear those statistics. I think that when you come to public life, you don't invent your ethics and your character. It's what you bring to it. And I think the jobs themselves help you reveal yourself. And, you know, my experience is that most people who choose to serve or chose with whom I served in the Congress had high ethical standards and, you know, great, sort of character compasses. And then you would have the, I think, exceptions, and the public really gets to see that. It's what's in the headlines. It's, you know, sort of what they see. And in some ways, it becomes how they define our various institutions. And I think it's really unfortunate because I don't think that completely represents, you know, what people bring to the table. And I know for me, Congress was not going to change who I am. It was going to help me better define it to those who were seeing me for the first time. And it would help, and it helped me to clarify my values and my standards.
That's powerfully said. And I love the rebuttal inherent in the question. Governor Haslam, same question about how you dealt with such cynicism when you were in public office, and what advice might you have for young folks who'd love to follow in your footsteps?
Well, first of all, I agree with Donna, and I'm like her. It hurts to hear that. My first advice to people who would like to do this is do it. It is almost hard to quantify the difference it makes to serve in government. I always thought it was important before I started. And after having served 15 years in public office, I'd say it's even more important than I thought it was. I think that people think about ethics in terms of, are they doing something for personal profit or gain? I actually think that what I would encourage people to think about is, forget about so much that you obviously have to think about people where they are in the political spectrum, but think about, is this somebody who really is trying to make a difference in what they're by what they're doing? Or are they there because they like playing the role? As somebody said, you know, I know some people they said, well, I'm not a real senator. I just play one on TV. Or I'm not a real congressperson. I just play one on TV. And I'm afraid that's what a lot of folks are doing. So I think that I would encourage people to think of it, ethics broader than just, are they looking for some personal gain that's, you know, monetarily based, and think of it in terms of, are they there because they really do care about the common good? Or is it more of a, I'm here because I love the politics of it?
I also love that frame. Thanks for dovetailing so neatly with Representative Edwards. Senior Counselor Rahman.
Yeah, thank you, Professor Kirch. And thank you to Congresswoman Edwards and Governor Haslam. It's a real privilege to be on this panel with you both. And thanks, Professor Bierbaum. I should say I'm a former student of Professor Bierbaum, so it's been a double treat to hear his lectures again in this forum. So, you know, I appreciate this question. And I should say, you know, I'm not an elected official, right? I serve in the Office of Management and Budget, speaking here in my personal capacity. But I would want to maybe put some kind of reframe the question a little bit, right? Because, you know, the frustration that I think you spoke to, Professor Kirsch, is it can be projected at an individual level, but I think it speaks also to some of the broader structural challenges that our democracy faces, the kinds of challenges that Eric Bierbaum was talking about in his lecture, right? And so when I think about public service in this regard, I think two things would be worth really highlighting. One is just how do we help create pipelines for public servants who are deeply rooted in the communities themselves, right? Who have those relationships, who are tied to communities that are struggling in different ways, and have an authentic voice, right? For those who really need representation and a seat at the table, whether it's in Washington or in state capitals or in city halls. The second thing is, what are those institutional changes we need to pursue to shorten that gap, right? That huge gulf between government as an entity out there that we don't really know what's going on and we don't really trust what government does and us. Because, you know, Franklin Roosevelt used to famously say that government is us. Government is the people. We are a democracy. But so much of our lived reality is not democratic, right? Whether it's campaign finance or issues of voter suppression or kind of these deep systemic questions around racial and gender inequity and injustice. So I would really want us to think about, A, get involved, absolutely. But B, how can we be involved in different ways, in elected office, in social grassroots movements, in community service of different forms that actually change the institutions to make us a more trusting small D democratic society.
I love this differential way you've each approached this. You had advice for fellow political leaders, you had advice for Americans as a whole, had advice for thinking about the particular issues that are involved in this way. And I'm gonna shake things up a bit, and as opposed to putting questions to all three of you, I'll come back to that. I'm gonna ask a personal question of each of you. You fellow panelists are, of course, welcome to add follow-ups or rebuttals. I'm going to go in the reverse order from how he opens. So, Senior Counselor Rahman, you're up again. I've actually taught your terrific book, Civic Power, in classes, which suggests that we face a crisis in American democracy and that there is hope for renewal. And you've got lots of wonderful ways of thinking that through. I'd like to ask you to focus on how character might or might not play a role, both in the crisis we face, that I think many of these audience members may share, and how character might play a role in the hope for renewal that you hold out towards the latter part of the book.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. And I know my co-author, Holly Rosen-Gilman, will be excited to hear that as well. I think character, one way to think about character, especially now as I'm learning in my new role, right, in government, as well as in my previous role in the advocacy world, I think character really is also a lot about how do you think about judgment in under moments of pressure and under moments of uncertainty, right? So like we can, as the academic in me would love to, spend a lot of time researching and build and thinking, looking at the data, looking at the evidence, thinking about, what's the right response in a moment. But of course, when you're confronted with it, right, there's so much that's moving fast in real time. There's really no substitute for individual judgment. And so when we think about what character means in, when you cash it out, I think it's those like mental heuristics in your mind that, when you're faced with a decision or when you're faced with a new situation, what are the questions that you're asking and who are the people who you're thinking of when you're asking those questions, right? And when we talk about the virtues of public service, I think it really kind of boils down to us building the mental muscle, the character, the virtues, if you will, to ask certain questions, right? Who is most affected? Whose voice needs to be heard that isn't heard in this moment? What are the things that I might be doing wrong that are sort of my own natural inclinations, but actually, I have my own limitations just like anybody else. And so like, what are ways that I can build muscle to check that against my own instincts, right? And so that's easy to say, hard to do, but I think that it's in those gray areas where what we're talking about is character, I think, really come out.
That's again, a wonderful frame, this idea that it's an individual judgment in a moment of crisis and uncertainty. I want to come back to that later, but thanks for that one distillation of, again, what is a terrific book. I know you got a new project that takes up some of the same themes, but I've really enjoyed reading and teaching Civic Power. Governor Haslam, you won your first political race for Knoxville mayor and weathered some pretty tough personal attacks from your opponent, Madeleine Ruggiero, I think is the last name. You later named her as a key city official working in your mayor's cabinet. And in fact, she succeeded you as mayor. What inspired that decision to name, again, an opponent who attacked you personally, which won you statewide and even national acclaim for what the Wall Street Journal called a remarkable act of character?
Well, the reality is that Madeleine, it's Ruggiero is her name, we had a great need for somebody to do community development within the city. And I knew that she was the best person in the city to do that. And campaigns are interesting, as the congresswoman will tell you, they're interesting personal experiences. If you've never been the vulnerability of being a candidate is hard to describe. And I think sometimes with campaigns, when they're over, it's best to say they're over. And what's the best thing now for the city or the state or the country or whatever the role you're playing is. So in my case, I just knew that we had a big need. That role was somebody that took the federal funds that came into the city and really helped address a lot of the social and community building needs we had in the community. Madeleine had a 25-year history of doing that. I knew she'd be terrific. And I'm really glad I put her in that position. And she ended up, like I said, our politics are really different, but she ended up being a terrific mayor herself for 8 years.
So the Lincolnian team of rivals move was not foremost in your mind, but that I remember is how it got cast at the time. Well, thank you for that. Representative Edwards, in Congress, you were known as a particularly ethical legislator. And I remember one moment when you were arrested along with John Lewis during a protest against genocide in Darfur. What main influences, whether people or religious views or philosophical principles, sustained your deep commitment to doing the right thing?
I have to attribute that to my parents. I mean, my dad was in the Air Force. He served for almost 30 years. And I think I can't even remember a moment in the time that I was growing up between my mother and father where they were not emphasizing things like integrity and honesty and and responsibility and taking responsibility even when, you know, it was a really bad outcome for you. And those things stuck with me. And I always viewed myself, especially as a leader, both as a community leader, but also in the Congress, as somebody who, you know, just wanted to call it what it was and, you know, not do a lot of sugarcoating. I was never very good at that. I'm not good at that now. And I think that always being really comfortable in who I am. And I think that's an important quality of, you know, sort of a character quality, a leadership quality, because if you have people who are mercurial and can change on a dime, it doesn't really serve it for me anyway. It wouldn't have served my constituents well, but also it didn't serve my gut very well. And so I think it was easy. I think one of the most difficult things for me was serving on the ethics committee. I actually wanted to serve on the ethics committee. At the end of the day, it ended up probably being, you know, a little dicey when you're sitting in, you know, reviewing your colleagues and their behavior. But I thought it was important because I believe in our institutions. And I think that our institutions have been challenged, but they are strong. And I grew up believing in government and loving politics and, you know, thinking that government could do some good in people's lives. And I continue to have that, you know, kind of hopefulness.
We are grateful that you do. I can't help but, having heard you talk so beautifully about your parents, ask your two fellow panelists if they'd quickly give a exemplar or role model who helped shape your character, or at least your understanding and exercise of it.
I'll go next. And you asked about the situation with Madeline O'Hara. I'll give you a great story about my father. My father was a fairly prominent person in town, and there was a new editor of the newspaper, of one of the newspapers back when we used to have two newspapers in those days. This new editor decided he was going to come in and shake things up. And he decided to, my father, like I said, was very involved a person in town, and decided to go after him with what I thought then and still think were very unfair attacks. Well, the world changed a little bit in 10 years. That was 30 years ago. About 10 years after that, I happened to be at my dad's office, and I saw this editor who was now had left the paper walk out of the office. And I said, "Dad, what was he doing?" He said, "Well, he wants me to help him find a new job." And I said, "You're kidding." I'm shocked that he would ask, and I'm shocked that you would help him. He said, "Oh, he's a good guy. He can, I really want to help him find the next step in his life." And to me, it was one of those moments of like, aha, that's what grace in person looks like. And so I'm like, Donna, it's easy. My best model was right in my own home.
You're both so fortunate. That's wonderful to hear. Senior counselor.
These are great stories. You know, I think we all have similar stories in terms of the importance of family and role models. You know, I'll share really quickly. You know, I think for both of my parents as expats, you know, we're a Bangladeshi. I'm a Bangladeshi American, first of my family to be born in this country. My parents were sort of young, 20-something radicals in their day as part of the independence movement in Bangladesh at the time, right, in the early 70s. And so much of their formative experience was listening to Dr. King and Malcolm X on Voice of America Radio as they were thinking about, you know, what was happening in their part of the world. And then me growing up hearing those stories, but then being now here based in New York where we are still, but just knowing that these are kind of family commitments, but also global struggles, right? That the kinds of things that they were inspired to then work on in their lives were still very much the same struggles, right? That are live even now, right? In so many ways. And so just having that personal connection to what is happening in the world is so important.
Honored by all three of your stories about your parents. And I'm so glad we had a chance to get that in. I've been listening carefully, as I know our nearly 400 audience members for this fabulous panel have been as well. And I'm putting together a picture of what virtues or character traits are most important for professional success, especially I think for the young professional. We've got many students on here. Here's what I'm hearing so far. If I could pick one out of each of your both stories and answers. Judgment, you suggested already, Sabeel, earlier on, that individual moment of judgment. Representative Edwards, consistency. You said how someone, and this is how you lived your congressional career, has to do the same and the right thing time after time. Governor Haslam, I heard forgiveness and grace in your stories. Is that a pretty accurate portrait? Would we agree as a panel on the virtues that might matter most, or do we need to add some things to it or subtract? You can question each other's if you like. Right now, I've got judgment, consistency, and forgiveness. What do you all want to add or take away?
Well, I think I would I'll never want to live, leave out.
I'll jump in with one.
Oh, go ahead. I know we have this delay going, so my apologies, Governor Haslam. I mean, I never want to leave out integrity. I just think that, you know, sort of who you are and what you bring and staying true to that is so important to character. It is both what you hold on to internally and what people see externally.
That's hard to argue with. I think I'd add humility. I've made a vow to never hire any more narcissists. I don't care how great they are at their job, but if they're ego driven, and I don't care if that's in academia, government, business, I don't care how strong they are, they're not worth it. And so I've just kind of made a personal pledge. You could be the best person in the world for that job, but if you're a narcissist, I would rather you not be on our team.
All of us who hire regularly for whatever institutions we part of are going to seek you out afterwards to get your narcissist filter test, so we can tell in advance. Senior counselor, you want to add anything to this? You started us off with this powerful judgment claim.
No, I love this. I'll maybe piggyback off of both integrity and humility and add another wrinkle to that, which is, you know, and I think of this as both integrity and humility in a different way, knowing what you don't know and being really, really open to the fact that real experts might not be the kind of credentialed card carrying ones, but are going to be folks who, you know, are living the experiences that you're trying to work with and help. Help think through. So, you know, when I served at Demos, one of the things we would often say, even though we were a think tank, is the real experts are actually not the think tankers, right? The real experts are folks in their communities who know the deep realities and the deep systems that need to change, right? And that we saw a lot of our job as being partners with folks who to help lift up their ideas and their voices. Right, because, and I think it's a bit turning on its head. I think sometimes when we talk about, you know, the virtues of who gets to serve and who can serve, we might unintentionally imply that there are some folks who are, you know, better suited for that. But I think one of the values is really like us checking ourselves to remind ourselves that actually the best knowledge and best ideas and most inspiring, you know, energy often comes in from other places, and your job is. Can maybe the best way you can do your job is to be a conduit for those ideas and those inspirations.
A beautiful extended riff on humility. And I think we have five traits that I have my text for my next class session. Let me, we're approaching the halfway mark. I say painfully, because I'd love to go on for a good long while, but let me shift the frame a bit. And in fact, let's look at those virtues of character traits: judgment, consistency, forgiveness, integrity, humility. These are individual virtues, what some philosophers call cowboy virtues, things you practice all by yourself out there on the prairie or wherever the cowboy is. And in fact, this is so American. We view character as an individual matter more than most other countries. In fact, my character is rooted in my upbringing, my religious views and values, and my own sound or poor ethical judgments. But there's a contrary view. Political philosopher John Locke, who knew a thing or two about character, said centuries ago that humans are like chameleons. We take our hue and the color of our moral character from those who are around us. I want to ask you each if that seems right, if in many situations, in fact, it's not our individual character, that maybe it's we tend to behave about as well as or poorly as those around us. That's an ethics of neighborliness or of the community. And if that's right, or at least partly right, how can we enhance the collective character of a group, the student body on a college campus or a law firm or the US Congress or the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the White House? In other words, if it's not just your character, but those around you that help shape the character of institution, how can we make places better?
I'll take the first swing and the wisdom will go in ascending order from here. I think one of the things we have to realize in terms of who we're surrounded with is not just obviously the character issue, but the sense that we as Americans are tending to clump more and more and live and work and worship with people who think just like we do. And that has its own impact on our character, not in the sense of deciding if you're going to steal a loaf of bread or not, but in deciding that we're right, they're wrong, and we have all the answers. And if you ask me, my biggest concern about the country, and I think it does turn into a character issue, is we're at each other's throats. And not only are we, like I said, not only are we divided, but we're mad about it. And we think the other side has bad motives. And, you know, there's something called motivation attribution asymmetry that says, you know, how much do I not just disagree with you, but think you think what you do for bad reasons. And supposedly, you know, as of even 5 years ago, and it's gotten worse, the motivation attribution asymmetry between the Republicans and Democrats in our country is greater than that between Palestinians and Israelis, which is kind of seen as the historic mark of disagreement. So I think the thing I'd try to encourage people is we'd only not only take on our character from the folks around us, but we assimilate our culture in those things that we assume to be right and wrong and true and false. And we need to be aware that we're taking it from a very like-minded survey.
A compelling statement against both the profound polarization of our moment and the fact that we tend to clump together with those who think, believe, and so on like ourselves. Interesting, again, shift away from the individual entirely character point. Fellow panelists.
Well, I mean, I really do believe in institutions, and I think where people might change, when we strengthen our institutions, those are the things that can, you know, move from one generation to the next. And, you know, and I worry that so many of the institutions that we, you know, that were our gathering places, whether, you know, that was a gathering place that was Congress under a different set of rules where people spent more time together and they got to know each other and then they got to do, you know, do the policy making. Or it's the union hall where everybody who, you know, sort of work, they may come from different households, but they have some place to gather. And I think we've lost some of those kind of institutions where we're able to find more in common. Professor Hirsch, you know this, but when I came out of Congress, I got in an RV and drove around the country for about 4 months. And I was in every part of the country that you can imagine, in rural areas and urban areas. And I talked to lots of people. And, you know, the minute you take off all of the various hats that we wear, we really do find that we share so much in common, but our political space doesn't allow us to talk about those commonalities as much as we talk about the differences. And I think that that, you know, causes the kinds of divisions and the sense that we don't actually have, you know, shared values and shared circumstances. And the way you, I think, change that is you begin to rebuild, you know, brick by brick, some of these institutions.
Poignantly and powerfully said. Go ahead, Sabeel, sorry.
No, thank you. Just to build on that, because I really, really agree with that. And I think so much of the collective nature of character, I think that you're getting at with this prompt, has to do with who you're in community with. And oftentimes the people you're in community with you don't have a whole lot of say in that, right? Like it's your workplace, it's your colleagues, it's your, it's, you know, where you happen to be born or where you kind of folks you have on hand. You know, I think just even in my own experience, I've been really lucky to have tremendous colleagues who I've learned so much from in each institution that I've been a part of. But just to what Representative Edwards was just saying, like, I think at a macro level, we could do a lot more to help sustain and support those institutions, whether they're political institutions or civil society institutions that are essential to creating those types of common bonds, but also to help keeping folks tethered to what, you know, the communities that they're a part of and trying to serve, right? I think some of that cynicism that, you know, we started the conversation with, I think in part comes from the fact that we have policymakers or government of, corporate CEOs or, you know, whatever, folks who have a lot of pull, who may or may not be as tethered as they could be or ought to be to the communities that they're serving and a part of. And that has to do with these institutions that I think Rep. Edwards is talking about.
Can I jump in with one thing real quick?
Absolutely.
This isn't your question, but it's just something that I don't teach as much as you know, many people on this call do, but when I teach in college classes, I'm always struck by how quickly folks are willing to talk about institutional brokenness, institutional racism, et cetera, which is not to be minimized. But I think sometimes we use that as an escape from our personal responsibility within that, from our, you know, from individual racism is a lot harder to address than systemic racism. And the same thing with the brokenness of our institutions in a lot of ways. So I think it is important to talk about the character of institutions along the lines of your question. I don't ever want us to always say it's the system's fault. I'm not part of the problem.
You know, Governor Haslam, I agree with that. I do think that, you know, it also has to do with building this sense that we are our institutions. Our institutions are not some third party out there. Our government is not some third party out there. And if it's broken and it's fallen apart, then I have a responsibility to try to fix it because, you know, if I'm not, I'm part of the problem. I think, you know, I know when I was in Congress and served on ethics, the ethics committee was always seen as something, you know, this sort of ostrich over on the side. And really what the reason for it is to maintain the integrity of the institution so that we don't lose that. It was about building the public character that we could all, you know, hold to a standard. But I think each of us has a responsibility in whatever those institutions are. And keep in mind, these institutions were never perfect before and they're not perfect now.
Well said.
We weave together what is becoming a mighty strand, both the exchange or really the convergence, the two of you just beautifully expressed with Sabeel's idea of keeping people tethered to their communities. We live in what I think could be described as a staggeringly important moment for ethics and character in public life. We're amid, and let us all pray, emerging from a terrible pandemic. We've been through a pretty wild ride the last 4 years, culminating in an insurrection at the institution in which you served, Representative Edwards, and I know other two of you were there frequently. We're also amid a mighty renewed movement for racial justice and equity in the wake of George Floyd's tragic death and so much that has been in the aftermath of the Black Lives Matter movement. What ethical guides can help us through this extraordinary moment we're in? I may have stumped us.
No, go ahead.
I can take a first crack, though. You know, it's an important and a challenging question. You know, I think because so much of what we're facing right now, I think, is a struggle between as folks are trying to sort of make meaning out of this incredibly difficult in so many ways, right? Even just this week, the latest violence in Atlanta and what that means for the AAPI community and for so many of us just still trying to find a place, right, in our country. I think it's a couple things. I think one is just feeling the call to serve, right, and sort of thinking about this moment, as Rep. Edwards was saying, you know, that it is us, right? These systems can feel so vast, but they're a product of a million decisions that individuals make, that policymakers make, that companies make. And so there are levers that all of us are have access to, but we are able to do that if we act collectively. So I think it's kind of one is just feeling empowered to act, that these are things that we can change. But second, that thinking about how can I do that in a collective, like with others around me, others in my community, with many, we can be strong. And then the third thing is that we don't have to have the answer today, but I think we do have to all show up in the fight, right? Because that's how we kind of struggle our way through.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time these days, as I'm sure you all do too, talking with young people about the value of public service, because I think we've gone through maybe a generation and a half of people who, as Governor Haslam said earlier, maybe just are not there for the right reasons, or they're there to serve themselves, but not really to serve the public. And we have to grow a new generation of leaders who want to serve because they believe in our democracy. They believe they have something to share and get them invested in that. And there are so many times when I'm with young people who really, say how both broken the institutions are, but that they would reject any possibility of serving. And, I think when I was a young person, I was looking at Barbara Jordan and Shirley Chisholm and many others who were in public life thinking, I want to be them. So we've got to create that in this next generation.
I'm going to piggyback on both of those thoughts. Our generation has become one that, talks a lot and values self-actualization, kind of being your best you. I want to be my best me. And I think it's so long from, we're 60 years from Kennedy saying, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I know that sounds kind of, sentimental and sappy in today's world, but that idea of the common good, we've let go. And I don't think the folks like us on this call have stressed that enough. And it's become okay to think that, yeah, your role in life is to be your best you, instead of to how do you help make this common society that you're a part of a better place.
If I could just tack on one more thing just to that, thinking about the governor's comments, I'm in the upper bound of the millennial generation, so I don't think of myself any longer as a young person, but still young-ish at heart. And but I do think part of the struggle right now, we're in some ways we're living in a moment of extraordinary, amazing activism, right? Just think about this last year, everything from the movement for Black Lives to the movement for climate change, Sunrise Movement, movements for immigration rights, democracy reform. There's so many things that are on the table. And you're seeing, young people, working class folks, people of color, they're powering these movements. And that's amazing and tremendous. But I think the struggle is, the issues are so existentially fraught and so real in terms of the threats to people's safety and well-being and to our community safety and well-being. And it's not clear that we're going to be able to solve some of these big problems, tomorrow, right? And so I think the challenge is in some ways creating conduits for that energy and that urgency, right? How do we flow that into the kinds of institutions that Representative Edwards is talking about, or civil society organizations, things that can that are bigger than any one person and that can outlast any one election or any one campaign, right? Because those are the things that are that endure and then can have real impact over time. But I think there's, so we're in a little bit of this moment where I think there is a lot of hope out there, but there's also a lot of nervousness that, well, what if this doesn't work? And I think it's sort of on all of us to help make it work so we can kind of channel that forward.
So as a college professor, I give you all an A for that really terrific sense of at least the framework for ethical guides that can help us through this time. And you've also, you know, come up with a definition or at least a set of virtues that are most important for professional success. Let me try to channel all that into this question. There's a general sense, again, it's pretty strong in the individualist US. Governor Haslam totally take the point that there's, you know, great things about personal responsibility and sense of individualism. But one of the offshoots of that is, and I think this is something the Character Project here at Wake Forest spends a lot of time thinking about, senses, you know, by the time you're in your, I don't know, late teens, your character's pretty well baked. Again, your parents, your religious influence, or so on. Can we teach character? Can you educate people to have better character? Could we improve the character of the rising generation of professionals that you're all talking about? Each of you had a notion it's possible, but you also talked about, instead of educating directly, conduits for harnessing their energy or, you know, ways of trying to restore a sense of shared purpose. Can we teach character, and should we do so?
You know what? I have to believe that there are things that we can teach that help to strengthen character. Because if you don't believe that, then you won't believe that any of the brokenness can be fixed. And so I'm not willing to go there. So I think that there are, I mean, there are tools that we can to give people. And there are vehicles that we can give them that help to help keep people on the right track. And, you know, and then that builds on or bolsters what they've already internalized maybe in their teens.
Encouraging, thank you.
I'm on Donna's team on this one. I think the most important thing a leader can do, and I'm defining leader in a broad sense here, is define reality. And part of reality is that character matters. And we're to say that, you know, the 20-year-old you're teaching in class or the 17-year-old high school senior or the 30-year-old to not emphasize that character matters is doing them a great disservice and is not defining reality. And I think our fear of doing that has led us to this world we're in now where, you know, we can have people talking about alternate truths and some of the other terms that have come out of DC in the last 5 years.
I think Governor Haslam emphasizing that character matters is probably the mantra for this conference. So very glad you voiced it. Thank you. Sabeel, on this interesting question about whether we can teach or educate, let's say, law students to enhance their character.
Right. I mean, as you're asking the question, I was thinking, you know, I hope it doesn't end at age 20 or whatever, because I feel like I'm still learning and have been learning so much, you know, from in Oxford and law school, you know, working in the activism advocacy world, even now, you know, every day. So I think we're always actually learning and building character. We may not be aware of it and we may not be intentional about it. And I think that's the twist, is that character does matter, but therefore we need to be intentional about how do we support ourselves and support each other in cultivating, building, supporting the kind of virtues that we're talking about in this conversation, because that's an ongoing challenge. That's an ongoing investment. And having a community of, you know, friends, peers, colleagues, mentors, people you admire, who you're learning from and observing from afar, right? These are the kinds of things that help sustain and deepen character over time. And I think we, you know, we can all be more intentional about supporting each other in that.
Again, I love what you guys are without any, you know, preview or pre-conversation are converging on all these questions. We also have about 15 minutes left, and unusually in my experience on these panels, we've got more people now than we did at the beginning. So we're gonna keep them hooked. All right, character matters. We can enhance it intentionally. We've got to keep people on the right track, to quote the three of you. We've talked a lot about virtues in public life and how to teach them and enhance them. What vices are most dangerous or tempting in the contemporary, and we're going to stick with public life now, in Congress and gubernatorial seats and the West Wing or in OIRA over in the OEOB? What kinds of vices in contemporary United States are perhaps tempting us off the path of good character?
I'll go first. Well, we talked about this a little bit, but the everybody is aware of the polarization, and everybody is, you know, sees it and sees the detriment. But I think the vice is in not realizing what we talked about earlier, that we all have this desire to be told that we're right. And so we want to talk to people that think like we do. And I want to watch the news that gives the slant on it that I like. That vice is so much easier today when there's so many different news sources that I can choose my news. And even my phone figures out what I want and gives me more of that news. And the vice of thinking I'm right, and they're not only wrong, but they're wrong for bad reasons, is one that grips all of us in such a strong way. And one of the things when I talk to people who are executives with, you know, with cable networks, Fox, MSNBC, CNN, you name it is. So we're always surprised how many people leave us on all day on loop because they want that constant reaffirmation that, yep, what I think is right. And that person on TV keeps telling me that all day and night long.
Yeah, this is a really tough one because I think that for me personally, bright lines are important when it comes to ethical behavior. And I think that there was a time, I think Governor Haslam and I share a birth year, we won't say what it is, but you know, we had Walter Cronkite, you know, a couple of news stations. All of us were kind of on the same page when we got our information. And we don't have that now. And there isn't one, you know, sort of a voice out there that keeps us all on track. And so I think one of the vices has to be, you know, finding, if you can't find that common thread, then it all falls apart. You know, when we don't, you know, share that common sense of what's appropriate and what's not, what is ethical and what is not. And I think that's where the damage to ourselves as individuals and to our institutions falls apart.
Yeah, I really appreciate these comments. You know, I think I've been very lucky to have tremendous colleagues in each of these spaces. So, you know, really great folks. One thing I'll just lift up hearing both the governor and Representative Edwards talking just now is that, as we think about the information landscape, right, the vices in some ways are actually even deeper than at the individual level. They're systemic, right? It's it has to do, like there's a structure to how media operates today, how the platforms operate, what their profit motive is. You know, you make more money by getting more eyeballs, and you get more eyeballs by feeding more and more stuff like what people already see and more extreme versions of what they already like. And this is well documented in terms of how the platforms work. So I just offer that, you know, as we talk about vices in our public life, what are the institutional changes we need to make as a country to how media operates, to how elections operate, right? That actually draw down the level of vice and encourage, support the kind of virtues we're talking about.
Right, and just jumping on there, because you nailed it. And for all of us to realize that outrage is a business strategy for media companies.
Absolutely.
So look, I spend a lot of time on television. and on cable television. And I know that from the top of the day to the end of the day, the goal is to repeat, repeat, rinse, and repeat. And I think part of the theory is that you have one audience at one time and another audience at another time. But the reality is, you know, for a set of people, that is all they're hearing all day long. And it really does reinforce whatever the vantage point they come from. And I think that in public life, we have to be careful not to feed into that. You know, there are parts of me, for example, that love C-SPAN and love the idea that we have wall-to-wall coverage of what goes on in Congress. On the other hand, I see more and more members who really are just playing to the camera in the, you know, in the hopes that they'll make it to the evening news or, you know, on a late night feed or something. And I think all of those things diminish what we were talking about earlier. They diminish the institutions and they diminish the individuals who serve.
Stirringly said, thank you. I'd love to pick up another theme that actually each of you has used this word at various points. You've all talked about trust, and when you think of social trust more broadly, Americans today, and especially the youngest Americans, the rising generation that we hope will pass through our universities and high schools and save us all. Americans today, again, especially these youngest Americans, trust political figures less than at any time in our recent past. They trust nearly all institutions except the military less than they used to. We trust one another less, especially as Governor Haslam noted earlier, if we're of the opposite party. I think we all regret this, deplore it. Some of you have given some reasons for it, in fact, whether it's polarization or systemic violations and so on. We've all agreed we can teach character. Anybody have any idea how we can teach, especially these young people, to trust each other and to trust our institutions?
I'll go first. One of the things that happens every year, regardless of who the president is they have, the president invites every governor and their spouse and most of the cabinet to the White House for a wonderful kind of five-course dinner where, you know, it's a beautiful black tie dinner. And I was sitting in President Obama's last year by someone, I won't say it is, but who was a hardcore Democrat, had been with Obama from the beginning, had worked for the Democrat National Party before that. And I said, what do you know now that you wish you'd known 8 years ago when you started? He said, I wish I'd known how hard this is. I wish I'd known how hard this is. I wouldn't have given George Bush such a hard time. He said, I still don't agree with his policies. Don't get me wrong. But he said, this is a lot harder than it looks on TV. And I think if we could help communicate the difficulty of the decisions, I'm going to botch the quote, but Martin Luther wrote, you know, he said, don't send your best to be preachers. The Holy Spirit does all the work there. Send your best to government, because there it's where the ambiguities of life have to be wrestled with. And I botched the quote. It's something to that effect. But that's what we have to communicate to people, is this is hard stuff. And getting the answers right is really difficult for the people who really want to work to get the answers right.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think I would just add the related piece to that is that, you know, trust has to be earned. Right? So like stuff, like it's really important that we try to figure out a way to make some of these institutions work for and deliver for communities so that trust can be, can have some foundation and not just be, you know, something that we exhort folks to or, you know, there's only so much you can trust on spec, right? And so, and I think it's related to what the governor was just saying, right? Because it is really hard. But part of the disservice is if we don't support folks through like muddling through the ambiguities, right? But then actually try to do the delivering for communities that need the help. You know, even if you disagree on policy, right? I think because I do think it's one thing to disagree on policy, but still sustain the basic functioning of these institutions versus, you know, Professor Beerbohm talked about the attacks on January 6th. Like, yeah, that is an attack on the very institution of the Congress and of our electoral system. And that, you know, we can't have that and still have build trust in our institution. So I think we need to actually deliver for people who are struggling and show that working together through public service, through collective action, actually can work.
I agree with both of those sentiments. I think that we have to be realistic about what is expected out of the political and policy making process. And I think I have been listening quite intently in this discussion over the last several weeks about bipartisanship and what bipartisanship means. And for too many people, bipartisanship just means let's not argue about stuff. And I don't think that's what it is at all. I think it's about, you know, sort of having, you know, a robust competitive debate around policy issues, and then figuring out ways that you can mix the sausage so that it comes out. And I think that we have, somehow or other, we have instilled in people the idea that, that we shouldn't even have policy debates. And I don't think that's how our system was designed to function. And I think that that minimizes the hard work that Governor Haslam described of what it means to govern. And we could do a lot better at teaching that so that the expectations that people have of what government can and will produce, it makes sense and that it's reasonable.
I want to just add to that. They are both dead right. And Republicans have too often been, you know, the Ronald Reagan quote about, you know, government is not the answer to the problem, it is the problem. We've been guilty of that. Democrats have been, you know, saying, well, you're just not spending enough. I mean, you can categorize it however you want. But the bottom of it, and what Sybil and Donna both said, is this stuff matters. You know, people hire the government, they hire us, they elect us to do something. And that is to produce to services in return for the taxes they pay. And we have not held that in high enough esteem.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard when, you know, you beat up on, you know, government's been beaten up on for, you know, 30, 40 years to now say, well, government works. Well, no one's gonna believe that. And you hear that reflected in our public dialogue, and we have such low expectation. And maybe that's why we are, in some cases, electing people who, let's just say, they're not living up to the highest bar, the highest standard.
You incredibly fortunate folks in the audience have heard over the past hour a proud, strong Democrat, longtime office holder, and a proud, strong Republican, longtime office holder, and a Washington bureaucrat discuss some of the most profound and important themes that exist at present. You've heard about the importance of judgment and humility and forgiveness and consistency and grace and integrity. You've heard a former governor rip right off his tongue, motivation, attribution, asymmetry. You've heard, most important, that character really matters. It can be enhanced, it can be taught, that trust can be encouraged, that folks can find their way past the extraordinary array of vices and stay on the right track. And you've heard, maybe most important of all, at this incredibly complex moment in American life, this historic juncture, that although working in public life, that working in what has long been called the noblest profession is really, really hard, and it can be profoundly rewarding. You've heard that from folks who've devoted their careers, devoted their lives to this work. We're so grateful you're with us for the journey. And if there were applause possible on a Zoom screen, I'd ask you all to stand and applaud this amazing trio of public servants and inspirations for us all. Thank you. And what a wonderful conclusion to the first part of the first day of this conference.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much, Provost Kirsch. Thank you so much, panel. This was amazing. I had people texting me throughout this panel saying things like, this is amazing. I want to follow up with you about this. How did you find these people? And I know that people all over the world are having similar reflections right now as they heard from you all. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking this time. I'm not going to try to put a cap on it any better than what Rogan just did, other than to say thank you.